In this episode of the Poolside Genius, we invite our resident NCAA football expert and all-around knower of knowledge, Steve Heck, to the show to discuss the media days in NCAA football. We also take a look at the new NCAA football coaching hires, and we take a look at Chip Kelly and whether it is the end of the up-tempo era. Enjoy the show.
This is Poolside Genius, where we always make a splash.
Today we have a very special guest, a friend of the show, Steve Heck, currently wide receiver coach for Kutztown University. He has been a high school offensive coordinator at Schuylkill Valley, at Central Catholic. He has coached junior high basketball. He has coached track, I believe, as well. He's written articles and been published in American Football Monthly and, you know, just an all-around knower of knowledge. Steve, welcome to the show.
Thanks, Cody. Thanks, Reams, for having me. This is a cool environment, getting all kinds of crazy drinks here. Glad to be here with you guys.
Now, obviously, with your college football coaching background, we'd like to talk to you a little bit about the media day and some of the absurdities that come out in every single media day. You have any thoughts that, you know, stick out in your head right away?
Yeah, the media days for these different big time divisions are funny because the reporters sit around for months trying to get these guys in a room, and everybody wants to make a splash. The coaches want to make a splash. The reporters want to be the guy that gets the story in the newspaper the next day. So my thing is, like with the Larry Fedora, how much of this is really scripted and how much of this is really genuine belief from these guys? I tend to think that a lot of this is planned to create a splash and to get, for example, it worked for Fedora because his remarks made even the Reading Eagle Times yesterday in the news, which doesn't cover college football in July ever. And
tell us real quick what you're referring to for people that might not know.
Well, the synopsis of Fedora's comments at the ACC Media Days were college football is under attack, and, you know, he likened the attack on college football, and he somehow, there was a correlation that he drew between America's greatness as a country and the military with the presence of college football.
And, you know, just to go back to your point that this is scripted, he magically could pull out of his pocket this whole idea that I met overseas with a U.S. general, and I said, hey, what makes America the greatest army in the world? And he said, because we play football. I mean, come on. Does that really come up? That's the first thing the guy says? Come on. I'm not buying it.
My problem with a lot of these guys, especially some of these Division I guys, is they're very myopic in terms of their global view. They're so into recruiting or scheming or building their program that they don't know what the price of bread is, you know. And I've worked with guys that were so into, they're so tunnel visioned into their thing, that when you step off the path of talking about college football, for example, and you start talking about, hey, there's an election here, that half these people aren't even registered to vote. Okay, because they don't have time to vote. They will tell themselves they don't have time to vote in season. Because the election usually takes place in November, and I bet you a lot of these coaches don't even vote because for them, the game plan is more important than voting.
Well, I mean, you know, you look at Jim Harbaugh, and he wears khakis and that blue sweatshirt every single day just so that he doesn't have to waste time. Nick Saban eats the same Little Debbie cakes every single day so that he doesn't have to waste time thinking about what he's going to eat. I mean, how over the top is that? Are these guys really spending that much time, you know, from your conversations you've had with guys, from people that you know?
Well, it's either the illusion that they want to put out there. It's like the old John Gruden thing. He came into the work at 2 a.m. and all that. It's either the illusion that they feel that they have to have out there, or it's in a way kind of sad that they're not well-rounded enough to know their environment around, and they're also they're educators of young men. So if I always try to tie in things that are going on currently with what we're doing as a football team. I try to have a grasp of current events and history and the economy and all those things. And the thing I work hardest at is not being a football-only voice, because I think there's plenty of those guys out there. There are plenty of coaches that will, when the meeting starts, the only thing the kids will hear from you is, okay, this is what's going on this play. And that's obviously important, but what do you talk about before and afterwards? And I think that if some of these guys are to be believed, they're operating in like this black hole of college football that the only objects and things that they have interest in are related to the bottom line of their program. And that, as an educator, when they beat the drum that, hey, I'm an educator, if that's the case, then they're that's a shame.
But how often do you hear these guys talk on podcasts, talk in interviews? Oh, you know, I want work-life balance. I mean, Urban Meyer, you know, talks about the contract with his daughter, and, you know, is that it just seems like a talking point, you know, doesn't it?
It does. I think it's convenient, but I do think they're like, I do think they're guys that there's a difference between being productive and putting time in, especially in the off season. A friend of mine coaches in a Division II school up in New England, and they meet this time of year. They're meeting every day from 8 in the morning till 5 at night. Our meeting schedule is a lot less restrictive than that. Somewhere there's a happy medium. You know, somewhere in there is probably the right thing to do. More isn't necessarily better. And I think some of these guys confuse putting time in with achieving results because they think that's what they have to do. But
you mentioned more isn't always better. In the last few years, I know the NCAA has put time restrictions on how much time coaches can actually meet with their players, especially off in the off season. How does that affect you, or how has that changed since you've been at Kutztown?
Well, it's funny because, and that's a good question, Reams. Just recently, the NCAA has relaxed some of those rules. And when I first started coaching in college, and that would have been in 2004, we had no real off-season access to our players in terms of skill development.
Okay.
If you were a high school coach, you're like right now, if you're a high school football coach, you're working with your guys more than any other college coach will, and you're working probably to the detriment of the game, but that's another discussion. But as a college coach, especially at Division II level, unless you're like a strength and conditioning coach and your kids are living on campus and you're working with them, your guys are back home working at their home high school fields, and they're working on their own with their high school quarterbacks or a handful of teammates that live close to them. As a college coach, you don't see them in the summer. And after spring practice is over, late April, I won't see my guys except for prospect camps. We'll do four of those. We did four of those this year. I will not see most of my guys in an athletic environment until August 5th. So from, let's say, April 24th to August 5th, my guys, I'm not putting them through any drills. And just recently, however, they relaxed some of the rules in terms of the winter workouts. So in the winter, you were really pretty much only allowed to do strength and conditioning, agility type things, no balls, no real equipment. About 2 or 3 years ago, the NCAA relaxed that and now allows you to do small group fundamental work with balls and equipment on the field, which is great for a guy like me and for our guys, because we took advantage of that. And that leads us into spring ball. It helps to get our fundamentals back. So
did they used to, you know, tape the towels up and,
yes,
you know, do stuff like that?
Yeah, it was. You had all kinds of. You could do. We literally would take white towels, fold them in the shape of football, and tape them together. But now, the NCAA's recognized that the world will not end if you're doing an hour or two a week of drill fundamentals. So.
Now, on the flip side of that, you know, you mentioned high school sports. Now, I think there, you know, states like Texas and whatnot, and even I believe in Ohio, they've severely limited certain times that high school football players, especially, can practice and work out. Do you see Pennsylvania going that way, or do you think it's a valid thing?
I think a lot of people would like to see Pennsylvania go that way. You know, I think Pennsylvania seems to be one of the the least reactive states. There, for example, the coaching certification that has just hit Pennsylvania within the last year, Pennsylvania is the last state to have required that in the union. So it seems like Pennsylvania is the last to start legislating these things. So if it happens, you know, it will be. Pennsylvania has had a long history of proud high school football tradition. I don't think the product will suffer. I don't think the product benefited from having, for example, 6:30 to 10 o'clock workouts 4 days a week in June. I don't think that's helping necessarily. I think the game has been over-coached and under-taught, meaning you're getting a proliferation of schematics and your fundamentals are still not where they need to be. So yeah, I think if I was the PIAA commissioner or chair or president, I would lean towards less organized group activities and more, hey, let's get guys together in small groups at certain times, and not, we don't need these 7-on-7 leagues just to keep score and throw a 2-yard pass and get a point for it. That's not helping the game.
Moving off of, you mentioned, you know, this whole topic of coaches being in touch with their players, and ultimately we're looking at coaches, you know, not necessarily trying to control them, but in that regards, how about Nick Saban, a coach that's, you know, we could all say is one of those control freaks. Talking about the NCAA media day today, he kind of had a little sparring match with the media. Interestingly enough, they were asking him, who's going to be your starting quarterback? And right away, Nick just goes nuts, mentioning, you know, the media is making up this this hatchet job on, you know, looking to who's going to be the quarterback. They're making this all up. And correct me if I'm wrong, Steve. I mean, the last game we saw Alabama play, didn't he, like, switch quarterbacks? He brought Tua in the at halftime, right? Correct me if I'm wrong. It was Nick Saban who did that, right?
Correct. Yep.
To me, what's your point of view on how Nick kind of interacts, and how does that actually help him?
I think Nick was preparing very heavily for SEC Media Days for that question. I would think he was like a presidential candidate that does a mock debate before the real debate starts. I'm sure he was in a room with some people, and he was waiting for that question to come up in about 9 different incarnations. And it's great. It's great for the SEC network, which ultimately helps Alabama, ultimately helps all the schools. It's great for all the media outlets that handle those things, because at the end of the day, you know, it's like, who remembers the Nick Saban pounding the podium when he was a head coach at, where was it, LSU or somewhere, and he said, guess I have to tell you guys again, I'm not going to be the head coach at Miami. And 2 weeks later, he was the head coach at Miami. So he's...
Well, and he also said, I'm not going to be the Alabama coach either, when he was at Miami.
And that's why the media loves Saban, because they here's the thing. As an ex-journalist, every guy in that room that goes to a Nick Saban press conference wants to be the guy that puts the pelt on the wall to get Saban to go sideways and off the train tracks and to have, you know, that type of moment. You want to have that question asked. So, and it was probably a huge fight in the media room. Who gets the first question to Coach Saban on SEC Media Days? Because they all were going to ask the same question, the starting quarterback controversy. And Saban was ready for it. And, you know, a lot of coaches would have kind of punted that maybe don't have Saban's, you know, gravita or reputation. Some of the coaches would have taken a more bland approach, but that's the beauty of Saban, is that he has this anger that he's like the Incredible Hulk, where all of a sudden, you know, he gets the pain, and, you know, the jack slips from underneath the car, and Bill Bixby turns green, and all of a sudden he goes crazy, and it's like this, what Pat Riley would call, you know, like temporary insanity. And that's the beauty of Saban, is that he can go from a mild-mannered, very professional CEO to this enraged, you know, early 60s, you know, figure that just is completely, he can't fathom that you have the gall to ask these questions. And the reality is, these guys are doing their jobs. And the reality is that Saban knows these questions are coming. So how much of this is a show, and how much of this does Saban enjoy, or, you know?
So who's the bigger pelt, though? Like, him or Belichick, you know? Or,
wow, well, of like, course.
Yeah, well, Belichick's the bigger pelt because Belichick, his blow-ups are barely audible mumbles that he'll say kind of, okay, we covered that already.
And one to Cincinnati.
Nick's blow-ups are pounding the podium and have an exasperated look where he bites his tongue, shakes his head, and goes into the whole, you know, the body language is beautiful. And that's what, you know, if you're a reporter or a TV network, you know, you heard the phrase, you move the needle. That's what, you know, guess what? That's what you want to have happen.
You know, the fascinating thing about both Saban, and probably we could say the same thing about Belichick, they've had Saban on College Game Day. He's been fantastic in terms of his analysis. He comes across not glib, certainly not a curmudgeon. He's actually personable.
The thing I love about Saban, though, is he's one of the few guys that can take the 45-second halftime interview or pregame interview. No, and unlike Popovich, who dismisses it completely offhand.
That's exactly what I thought about.
But Saban will actually give you true emotion of, like, you know, we got to run the ball better, or we got to straighten some. Like you can see the angst in his voice and his body. He's not a guy that hides his emotions.
But the funny thing is that the score is probably 21-7 Alabama.
Correct. Yeah, but that tells you that gives you a portal into Saban's success is right. That, you know, he will blow up things. And for example,
you
keep
him focused.
He's known to be the defensive backs coach at Alabama, that's his specialty. So if one guy gets out of position by an inch, he turns that into, we blew six coverages, you know, and that's the beauty of Saban.
I heard A.J. McCarron be interviewed somewhere, and he was saying, like, in the national championship game, they were cruising, you know, and he comes and he's in at halftime and says, if you guys play like that again, we'll never win another national championship. You know, and they just blasted whoever they were playing that year, and it was just like, everybody just, like, stops and, like, you know.
Yeah,
but
if that's the tone that's being set from the head guy, then all the assistants, their jobs are easy. It's the problem in coaching is when the head guy rolls in, and he's rolling into halftime, and you're down by four touchdowns, and the head guy's like, hey guys, we gotta pick it up a little bit, and all the position coaches and coordinators are looking at themselves like, all right, we're gonna have to be the bad cops and rip kids. When your head guy's in there ripping kids. When you're up by 20, you know, against directional Southwest Louisiana Tech, hey, it's easy for a position coach or a coordinator to come in then and now. The reality check's already been sent by the head guy. Now you can come in and get on scheme and the small adjustments you need to make.
It's interesting you mentioned all his assistant coaches. I mean, that can get us talking into all the different hires. It's fascinating how it seems like if you're an SEC team, you better latch on to one of Saban's assistant coaches, it seems like.
Yeah, but I think there's a mixed bag for success with I tend to think that, you know, I tend to think that Saban's assistants are kind of similar to Belichick's assistants. It's not, you know, did Bobby Williams light the world on fire at Michigan State?
What about Mac?
There's another one. I mean, I tend to think that, you know, everybody wants to get the recipe is, hey, let's hire Alabama. So what you do is you end up forgetting who you're hiring. You think you're hiring Nick Saban light, but the reality is, hey, I'm hiring Alabama's coordinator or special teams coach or running backs coach, and may not be the best hire. So, you know, note to the ADs, do your research. Don't take the easy way out and just hire the hot Alabama assistant.
Moving on from the Saban hires, we're going to take a look at some of the new fresh faces around college football and see what Steve's take is on some of those guys. Let's start off with the guy I think probably has the hardest job in college football this year, Josh Heupel at UCF. What do you think you know, the best case scenario is for him?
Best case scenario is he's got to go undefeated.
So that he can win a second straight national championship?
He's got a very difficult job because he's following a guy that was quickly, you know, crowned the king of South Florida, or you know, Scott Frost and was the hot hire for everybody and wasn't there long, but came in and had an immediate impact, kind of cleaning up the program and going from a one-win team to a team that was, you know, making all the big Power Five schools nervous in terms of knocking down, getting in the major bowls. You know, if Heupel has a great year, wow, he's riding Scott Frost's coattails. If he loses two games, it's a total awful hire. Why'd they hire this?
Yes,
why'd they hire Josh Heupel?
Yeah, Scott Frost would have been undefeated again. Yeah. You know, come on.
Yeah, and he's in a difficult spot. However, it seems to be a good job. You know, it seems to be you're in a winnable conference every year. They should be in the top two or three regularly just with their recruiting base. And the tradition is limited in that conference. But, if he's a competent coach and if he has a good staff, he should be fine.
Now, here's my big question about that. Is he a competent coach? I mean, you know, you've looked at his career as an offensive coordinator. It was kind of up and down. I mean, he was with Stoops in Oklahoma. Then I believe he was out at Cal, right?
Yeah.
And then... you know, he was at Mizzou, you know, did some nice things with Locke there. But, you know, I've never really seen him as this hot coaching candidate. Maybe that's just he doesn't have the hype. But, you know, should he be getting a UCF job at this point in his career? Is he deserving?
I think he benefited from a lot of openings. I think of Chad Morris's of the world going to Arkansas and all Tennessee going through a laundry list of hires. I think in this hiring cycle, Heupel benefited from a lot of movement and a lot of big-time programs. And when the music was getting close to stopping, he probably got a job that he wouldn't have gotten in a coaching cycle change that was less volatile. So I think he benefited from that, no doubt about it. But, you know, it's funny because 90% of the hires these days are offensive-minded guys, and that helps him. His background helps him. The people, you know, he's Oklahoma pedigree, you know. So he has more things going for him, but you still have to do it. You know, you still have to go out there and win the recruiting battles. He's going against Charlie Strong in his conference. That's gonna be a big test for him to see how he handles probably a really good spot for Charlie Strong. In a good program, so he's got to right all out of the gate. He's got to take down that team. They'll have that game circled.
You brought up Frost. Obviously, he moved to Nebraska. What do you think Scott Frost will do with Nebraska? Will he bring anything new to the Big Ten?
To a team that's not
necessarily done real well in the Big Ten.
No, Nebraska's been by most standards kind of treading water, you know, in the Big Ten West. Should be a winnable division with Nebraska's resources. You could arguably say that Nebraska, is there a team in the Big Ten West that has more tradition than Nebraska? Absolutely not.
No.
So I think Frost, if you believe what you read and if you connect the dots, Frost will bring the best of all the worlds to Nebraska, meaning He will bring some of the Chip Kelly, quote unquote, innovative stuff without maybe some of the Chip Kelly stuff that seemed to blow up and go sideways and not work. And I think obviously the big thing with Frost is he knows Lincoln. He knows the social domain of the program. And he's not Bill Callahan. He's not Mike Riley, who got in there and took 3 years to learn it. Bo Pelini was winning games, eight, nine games there, but because he was so abrasive, the athletic director decided, hey, winning nine games isn't enough. So Frost may have, you know, the phrase in management is he checks all the boxes.
So when you say, you know, Pelini was winning nine games, is Nebraska, you know, totally overrating themselves in terms of now competing in the Big Ten, or have they just simply lost their way?
I just want to say something real quick there. I think the fans think, you know, Tom Osborne, you know, it was only yesterday that Tom Osborne was roaming the sidelines. You had Roger Craig, you know, running in the backfield. You had Rathman, you know, and Scott Frost himself was there, you know. And I think it's, you know, something that I think Penn State had a little bit going on there for a while where they thought it was still the 80s, you know, they and, you know, with Nebraska, they thought it was still the 90s. And they thought, wow, we are, you know, we're up right up there with Alabama and USC and, you know, these premier college programs. And no, you've kind of fallen quite a bit. But anyway.
Yeah, well, I think Scott Frost has the unique ability to insulate himself from those expectations because he's part of that lineage. So unlike other guys where the fan base would say, oh, if we just had Turner Gill. Oh, if we just had Scott Frost. Oh, if we just had the ghost of Tom Osborne. But to me, the expectations at Nebraska should be, should they, because Wisconsin has stolen their thunder. Wisconsin is the team in the Big Ten West that has done the most with the limited resources that they have compared to their brethren in the East. But Nebraska should be competitive with Minnesota, Iowa, Northwestern, all those teams. There's no reason they shouldn't be competitive. And that's why Frost is hired. You know, he's... They got both things. They got a Nebraska guy, which will allay some of the local, you know, guys that are wearing the red underwear to bed. And then they got an innovator, quote unquote offensive innovator. They have a rare combination of a guy that has a cutting edge offensive mind, and he's a proven winner as a head coach. Usually you get those guys, and you have to kind of cross your fingers and hope, boy, I hope he's a CEO. We know he's an OC. I hope he's a CEO. Well, Frost is able to do both those things. So,
Bender just brought up, you know, Nebraska's falling off the turnip truck ever since Osborne. How about this program, Florida State? I mean, are they a top five program or are they just, you know, what was it, 4 years ago, riding the coattails of Jameis and his crab legs? I mean, where do you see FSU going now that they've changed from Jimbo to Willie Taggart?
Yeah, remains to be seen with Taggart. You know, he seems like he's bounced around a lot, and you know, Oregon, his best work, Western Kentucky. Florida State will be his biggest challenge to date. It seems like he wasn't at Oregon that long. And again, volatile cycle of coaching hires gets him to Florida State.
But is Florida State in your mind?
In that conference, sure, they are. They have to be.
Yeah.
The ACC, I mean, who's in the ACC that is scaring everybody?
Clemson
and Florida State.
Right.
Yeah. I mean, yeah, and you're not going to look at, like, Tech, you know, love Paul Johnson, but he's not, you know, they're not going to be on that same level.
Florida State should be a very attractive job to a lot of coaches. And you know, again, I just think that when Jimbo Fisher goes to Texas A&M, I just think that eventually the job like that wears you out in one place, and I just think it was a time for him to move to Texas A&M. You know, I don't think he left Florida State because he didn't think they could win. I think he left Florida State because he thought different environment, different challenge, you know, and got a hell of a payday.
Yeah, that's true.
When you Willie Taggart, like you said, I don't see where the shine is there. I mean, he's a Harbaugh guy, you know. Is that what makes him that interesting? I mean, they always say, well, he was in Florida, you know, he was at USF, you know, all those things, but I just don't see it with him. I don't see him being the Florida State premier coach.
But the problem is, Cody, the pool of those guys is getting shallower and shallower every hiring cycle, because every hiring cycle, a couple coaches drown and or get tarnished. Butch Jones, Jim McElwain. 5-6 years ago, those guys were riding high. Now they're, you know, analysts and position coaches. The pool for athletic directors at that Division I level, in their mind, is very shallow. Why? Because they struggle thinking outside the box of who am I. Years ago, you would see guys getting hired from FCS to a Division I low-level job, then from a low-level Division I job to a higher-level division. Those days are over. You used to see guys going from Division III to Division II. Rarely happens anymore. Let's think about this now. Guy I worked for, Raymond Monica, was the defensive coordinator at North Alabama that won 3 national championships at a Division II school. That whole staff gets hired at Temple in the early 2000s and was at Temple for 7 years. Think about that. Would you take a Division II staff right now and from Northern Alabama and put him in Temple? That would never happen today.
No, and I think, you know, that's part of the problem. I don't think that they're looking at those outside-the-box hires like you just said. I think that there are a lot of guys. I mean, look at Joe Moorhead. He had to go from, you know, a tremendous program that he built up at Fordham to being Penn State's offensive coordinator. Now he's got, a pretty good job at Mississippi State. But, you know, it's fascinating that he had to take that step back to be able to make it to the next level.
And the reality is, it's not just at the head coaching level. The coordinator level is probably where the biggest lack of imagination occurs among head coaches. Let's give Mike Gundy credit for being one of the guys on the vanguard of bringing in Mike Yurcich from Shippensburg University. Hires him out of obscurity, really. And you know how Mike Gundy found Yurcich? The same way everybody else discovered Mike Yurcich. He looked at the statistics for Division II, saw Shippensburg high on the list, and said, let's give this guy a call. And not that Oklahoma State was struggling offensively, but Mike Gundy was the offensive coordinator before Mike Yurcich got there. And they went from very good to really good.
And I think a big point of that is that, and I think Gundy's talked about this, is that he plucked him from obscurity, relative obscurity, and now he's been able to have him there for a while. People aren't looking to hire him right away, even though he thinks he probably should have been hired by now. Yeah. I mean, why not take a chance on him over some of these guys that are getting hired at all
and recycled?
Of these other, yeah.
Yeah, there's no doubt. And let's give Ole Miss credit for hiring Phil Longo from Sam Houston State, Casey Keeler. They made a deep run into the playoffs before they ran into a juggernaut. Phil Longo, another local, a lot of ties to local football around here, was the head coach at LaSalle. It was a wide receiver coach at Slippery Rock. Really bright offensive mind, excellent coach. Did really nice things at Sam Houston State. Now, Ole Miss, you know, Phil Longo's in position now to really have a good spot launching forward for a head coaching job.
Now, do you think that Matt Luke is going to be able to maintain or improve as a head coach so that Longo's going to get that recognition, that get that chance? Because, career O-line coach, you know, he hasn't really done anything else. I'm not necessarily buying him. You know, is he another Coach O? I mean, with less charisma?
Well, you know, what you ask yourself is, how much of a mess is he? Like, was he their best option in terms of, quote unquote, guys that would have taken that job? I mean, there's a reason Luke has the job is, you know, maybe a lot of guys really didn't want it, and Ole Miss was smart enough to realize, hey, we have a guy we kind of like that the players like, which is always kind of a dangerous thing because the players always like the coach that's there now. You know, especially if you're like, look at Clay Helton at USC, the players really went to bat for him, and for the most part, it worked. But you wonder, and none of us know this for sure, but you wonder, what is Ole Miss dealing with in terms of what's the status of that program? Depth, sanctions, you know, did they kind of look around and say, hey, Luke is a stabilizing force, kind of a Gerald Ford type stable, you know, just get us through a bridge coach to get us through to our next hire? You know, only time will tell.
There's no doubt I'm sitting in between two football guys here. Let me just remind both of you, you play to win the game.
Oh.
Come on.
Talk about
Arizona State. Of Arizona State. Come on. Herm Edwards, you play to win the game. I mean, what a retread. I mean, along with Sumlin at Arizona.
Retread. Don't you have to be a college coach to be a retread? You know, you know what I mean?
Yeah,
like,
really.
He hasn't coached in college since, like, 88 or 89. I mean, what in the right, you know, what caused the AD to say, Herm Edwards is the guy I want? I mean, they thought they were going to keep the OC. They were going to keep the DC. The DC retires. The OC, gets another job. I mean, it's comical. He didn't know what you know, what the mascot was. Like, it was like, oh my God.
Yeah, the journalists, the beat writers that cover Sun Devil football, it's Christmas for them every day because, you know, you get Herm and you get a storyline, you know, it's late November, you know, and they're scraping through to try to get into the, you know, Pool and Weed Eater Bowl, but you got Herm, you know, so you can still fill your column with Herm quotes. So
he'll be reliving the miracle of the Meadowlands, for goodness sakes.
Joe Pistarchik under center.
Yeah. I mean, and you brought up Sumlin. I mean, I've used Sumlin in a little bit different light. I think he's a much better coach. I think he had success there at Houston. I think he had success at Texas A&M. I mean, that was a down program when he took over.
Correct me if I'm wrong, though. Didn't it take them a good amount of time to finally hire him? I mean, am I wrong with that? Or it seemed like that dragged on for a while.
Well, I think part of that was because I think they wanted Coach Ken from Navy, but then Khalil Tate went out and said, I'm not playing in the triple. Well, guess what, buddy? You've essentially been playing in the triple. You know, it's a zone and a little bit different there from that perspective. But what Rich Rod does, and it has a lot of similarities to that. So, you know, they kind of soured on that. You know, they didn't want their biggest star to leave. And, you know, so I think Kevin Sumlin, you know, that's a much better hire than some of these other schools are making, I think.
If you're Arizona and you look around and it's a late hire for them because of the things that happened to Coach Rodriguez, I think they're fortunate to have a guy like Sumlin available to them that wasn't part of a big scandal anywhere else. It's not like they had to hold their nose and hire him. The biggest knock on him was the turnover at the quarterback position at Texas A&M seemed to be a constant. You know, his reputation is as a offensive coordinator, quarterback whisperer, and they seem to have a lot of turnover there. But I tend to think that may be a great fit for everybody involved. It may rehabilitate Sumlin's career if it needed to be rehabilitated, and I think Arizona may inch forward in that conference with all the different shakeups. They might be positioned the best. And again, you have your main rival hiring Herm. Doesn't hurt this, you know, Arizona.
Another Kevin Sumlin idea. Jimbo Fisher says that his former office looked like a nightclub. I mean, he was getting ready to redecorate that right away in Texas A&M.
Was Johnny still there? Manziel.
Oh no, he's up in Canada riding the pine.
Yeah, some of these head coaches' offices are, it's amazing how much money is sloshing around these programs. These offices are, you know, refrigerators in them and all kinds of accoutrements. And, if these guys are, now you got to remember, head coaches watch film in their office. So, you know, they're not like the rest of the world where, you know, you have a meeting room to go to or you have a cubicle. The head coach's office at a Division I level has got a lot of trophies, a lot of jerseys, a lot of autographed stuff, and it's an entertainment center for recruits. You're meeting with recruits and stuff. So those offices they're important things. So,
all they need is a pool, poolside.
Hey, Lane Kiffin's
that's the next
pool,
thing.
Right?
Yeah, that's the next thing coming.
We're going to stay on the West Coast and move up to UCLA, the big fish, Chip Kelly. You know, it's funny, you know, everybody's applauding this and, you know, saying, wow, this is a great hire for UCLA. You know, he's going to bring everything in. Troy Aikman's there shaking the pom-poms. You know, they're getting really pumped up for the Warp Speed Chip Kelly experience. But what's your take on Chip Kelly as a hire? Where do you see Chip falling?
It's after he left the 49ers. He made some tours and stops to visit with teams, study systems, Navy, hung out with the Patriots. I'm fascinated to see what that one-year hiatus got him in terms of evolving his belief system. Because if it didn't get him much, UCLA is not the type of program that will be able to just kind of roll through the Pac-12. But if he morphed and gleaned some ideas from the different stops he made and has adjusted and is changing things, and I don't know that to be the case, then it'd be very interesting to see what the 2018 Bruins look like if they're a replay of Oregon Ducks, you know, and because it seems like a lot of the schools have gotten comfortable defending that, or if he is now interspiced and mixed in some different ideas that he would like. I would wait. I'm from Missouri. You got to show me. So
it's interesting. I mean, there's so much to unpack with Chip. You know, you mentioned, you know, did he, when he goes to visit Navy or he visited Belichick, me being an Eagles fan, he used to do that when he was in Philly. I mean, on off days, he'd just run down
because
to
he's
Annapolis.
Because he has no life and he's not married. And he's a football junkie.
Absolutely, but
for a football junkie, he never really changed that much.
Yes, that's the question.
No.
If that's the only two places he's gone to,
but here's the thing: that's his socialization, going to hang out with other guys. That's his. You know, everybody else goes to nightclubs or pools or concerts. You know, Chip Kelly goes and watches practice. You know,
wow, you're killing Chip there, Steve.
Hey, there's nothing wrong with going and watching practice. No. It's just if you learn something from it, you got to use it.
Every practice I've gone and watched, I've come home and I've had some notes in my head or things I've written down that I said, boy, I like that idea, or boy, I'm glad we don't do that. It'd be interesting to see what Chip does after he goes to these places.
I mean, looking back through his NFL experience at both places, you know, the big minus or the big negative to Chip is he never adjusted. You know, he came in as the Eagles head coach. The first year was fantastic. He caught the NFL a little asleep, and they caught up to him. That second year was a good year, but then they fell on some hard times late, and then that third year when he had that whole control issue, that just went down the toilet. But ultimately is, could he adjust? And that's moving forward, that's going to be the question.
Yeah, and I think you can't really take a whole lot or anything really from his San Francisco days, because I think that, you know, that was a shotgun marriage. You know, they didn't have a good team at all. They didn't really have the players there, you know, for anybody to be really successful. And the GM, there was backbiting. You know, I don't think you can take anything from that, but I just think the myth of Chip Kelly, oh, I'm so learned. I go and talk to all these experts. I'm outside the box. Yet, you kind of were inside the box, Chip. You know, you kind of did the same stuff over and over again. You know, we're not doing something because we've always done it this way. Well, guess what? You're doing it the way you've always done it. And when you stop seeing those results, you know, the fascinating thing for me is, you know, watching those San Francisco 49ers games when he was there, they put up like 17 points in the first half. And they, you know, it was like, okay, wow, you know, this looks like a competent offense. Second half comes and they would get shut out or they would barely score in the second half until it was garbage time. And, you know, what causes that? That they were not adjusting? Because I know Chip, he would have about five plays or so that they would go rapid fire in the very beginning of the game. And then a lot of times he would come out with that same script right out of the half, and it seems like everybody adjusted at half to what he was doing, and he just never kind of caught on. And I think that, you know, if something's got to change, and he doesn't have a lot of his cronies. I mean, he's got Jerry Azzanaro there still. You know, funny thing, he was talking at a coaching clinic and said that, you know, Chip, hey, you know, they don't really run the RPO. You know, it was all play action pass, you know, which is just ridiculous if anybody has watched what they do, you know, at Oregon, at Philly, at, you know, at San Francisco. You know, so it'll be interesting. And you notice the quarterbacks that they brought in, Wilton Spate, and then they also have, you know, the dual threat, Robinson, I believe is his name. You know, so it'll be interesting to see what style, you know, is he going to go with the Nick Foles type quarterback, or is he going to go with the more athletic and kind of Mariota type guy?
Is he going to benefit from, as a college coach, will he benefit from the ability to recruit around his system instead of being an NFL coach where you have to patch the team together on a limited roster? Will he benefit from the idea of targeting a certain type of player at his different, especially offensively, let's say, positions? Whereas in the NFL, free agency, your budget, your salary cap, you kind of get stuck with the scraps you have left. Will he benefit from being back in the college game?
I don't know, because I think in the NFL, part of what hurt him was that he had his very, very strict parameters for physically for each position. You know, they had to be a certain height, you know, and, oh, he's too short to play corner for me, or, you know, and those types of things. And once you, you know, and, you know, you can go back to Parcells.
Hand size, right?
The hand size, yeah. I wouldn't be making his team anyway. But you look at it, Parcells would say, well, if you're making a an exception for one guy, then you're going to have a team full of exceptions. Well, Chip made no exceptions, and I think he missed out on a lot of really good players. So we're going to definitely see, you know, what did he get out of this experience?
It kills me sitting here. And if I could rewind, you know, I would be able to, you know, support Chip. And now, 2 years after Chip has left, the whole narrative of the Philadelphia Eagles has totally changed. But you know.
No, wait. I do want to rewind very quickly while you're talking about rewinding. You're the guy that said, you know, Laurie's making the big mistake. You almost stopped being an Eagles fan solely because they were getting rid of Chip. You know, oh, it's over. Oh, my God, Howie, he's terrible. They'll never succeed with him.
At that time, I was totally on board with the fact that they should not have fired Chip. And, you know, coming off of 13 straight years of Andy Reid, where it had become predictable. And he had, you know, gone to five NFC championships, you know, and just, you know, laid goose eggs in four of them. It just, after a while, it gets predictable. So Chip comes in, fast talking with a totally different system, something that was totally new. And to be honest with you, you know, looking back at his Oregon days, I mean, West Coast, you didn't really get a chance to see all the games, but it was electric back then. And I also thought the way he handled big events or negative events, the LeGarrette Blount issue at Boise State, I thought he handled it well. So coming into the Eagles, he also had another issue with Riley Cooper. I thought he handled the big issues well. Little did I know, and I don't think any fan really can see inside the NovaCare Center what's really going on. There's no way that anybody could recognize that Chip was a difficult person to deal with.
Well, I think all the media people that covered him in Oregon would say, yeah, he's really difficult. I'd also say you used the word predictable, which is very much like Chip's offense. I mean,
right.
It was funny. You know, I remember reading or listening to a clinic talk he gave, and, you know, he's telling you, well, if my running back lines up, you know, even with the quarterback, you know, we're doing our pin and pull, our outside zone, or if he's slightly back, you know, it's going to be inside zone, zone read sort of thing. Well, guess what, Chip? You know, he's like, well, the defenders look at it, and they're paying attention to that. We're going to win. You know, they're not focusing on the right thing. Well, guess what, Chip? They figured it out in the NFL, and that was a big-time problem for you.
Sure, and at Oregon, he had, you know, the chance to have over 100 players where you could just keep them fresh coming in like a wave. In the NFL, they couldn't do that. Back to that point, though, you know, here I am an Eagles fan. And the last thing I'm going to say is, you know, I'm just dying for a Super Bowl chance. And, you know, with Chip coming in, you know, you're just trying to latch on to anything, something different.
Chipadelphia.
And, you know, it went sideways. And granted, at the same time, though, Howie Roseman, since that time, has certainly rehabilitated his image with some fantastic moves. You know, kudos to him. He's turned it around from that 1 year exile. But at that time, you know, you mentioned the media wasn't really, you know, showing positive things to Howie either. So, you know, there was a lot of rumors like, does he get along with people? Can he work with people? I mean, Louis Riddick left, a couple other people had left that were front office guys because Howie just had to have that big ego. It was a clash of egos between the two of them.
Well, yeah, and here's the thing. It's fascinating. You know, it's like this myth that, you know, this myth around him that, you know, everybody thinks, oh, wow, there's got to be some magical reason. There's something special about him because it sells. People want to hear about Chip Kelly. They're fascinated by it. I mean, they're still writing NFL articles about Chip Kelly, you know, and he's been gone for 2 years.
You loved him at the Niners, though, that first year.
I was interested to see how Kaepernick would be able to work within his system and, you know, obviously got decent results in terms of his actual production and stats, but team lost. So, you know, again, when you don't get the results, you got to switch it up. Now, getting back to
Tom Sula.
Tom Sula. Come on. Let's not bring up Tom Sula. Anyway, you're looking like
great D-line coach.
Great wow. D-line coach, yes. Anyway, you know, speaking of results, you know, Chip Kelly came onto the scene, his warp speed, you know, him, Gus Malzahn, are we, Steve, at the end of that warp speed of the no huddle being, you know, tempo being all that matters, you know, at the expense of techniques, fundamental scheme? Like, because it seems like all those guys are at a point where they're starting to struggle a little bit by just doing the same old, same old.
It peaked a few years ago. It's ebbed since. I think people got more creative in terms of how they can communicate play calls, the rise of the signs, the big boards, the three play packages that you would run. You would, for example, one of the things we did at Kutztown was we would hold up a logo, let's say a pistol logo, and that told our three players, we are going to run these three relatively simplistic plays in this order once we see that logo. And that allowed, and it proliferated everywhere. But with that, with the rise of the tempo, defenses had to adjust and come up with communication systems to handle that. So it's always an ebb and flow. And we were kind of talking off camera. I thought not long ago, David Shaw and Jim Harbaugh were going to innovate the rise of the 6-5-4-3-2 tight end package. And that's where college football was going to head with these, you know, seven man surfaces and five or six tight ends in the game. And thank God we're not going that direction.
It's interesting because if you think about Oregon always struggled with Stanford.
Yeah, and it's probably because they couldn't simulate the practice physicality of what Stanford was rolling out there with, you know, with all these extra surfaces with wings and H-backs and, you know, converting offensive linemen to tight ends. You know, Oregon wasn't built to do that. So if you're not built to do that, you have a hard time simulating it at practice. But
and then Stanford seemed to control the clock, and it just got under the Oregon skin.
It did, and it made Oregon uncomfortable, and it changed how the whole dynamic of the game was tilted towards. As long as Stanford was on schedule,
right,
and not getting into negative plays, Oregon's high-octane offense was kind of antsy over there on the sideline. And then when they got on the field, they felt like they had to score every time they touched the ball, and you begin to press. So,
yeah, and I think, you know, you look at Oregon's defense, it was built to get turnovers so that they get the ball back. And with Stanford, they're not going to turn the ball over. And that's what ends up really causing a lot of
also to play from a lead also, which changes how you're – defending.
Absolutely. And you know, with Stanford, they were smart because you get those freshmen or those redshirt freshmen, those younger offensive linemen, those highly recruited guys, and you're able to get them experience early on. And that's why they've had a lot of success with some of the fantastic linemen like DeCastro.
The downside to the tight end heavy offenses is there's not a lot of those dudes walking around that can play tight end. That have a little bit of a bit. There's a ton of quick receivers out there to recruit. The tight end position is probably the most valuable outside of like quarterback, left tackle, and corner. If you have a tight end that has ability to walk and chew gum, he has a chance to go to D1 school. There's a couple around here in this area. There, you know, there's a kid that got signed by Wisconsin that plays at Warwick. Your tight ends, there's not a huge pool of them. So if you're basing your offense on having multiple tight ends, you damn well have to recruit at a high level at that position. But the good news is you're only recruiting against a handful of schools, Wisconsin, Pitt. There's Michigan. You're not recruiting against everybody for these tight ends because guess what? A lot of these schools, they don't need them.
Well, yeah, and not only that, but hasn't the tight end position almost become like a slot receiver in a lot of respects, and they're not asked to block quite as much as they had in the past?
Yeah, if the problem is, though, would you rather have – as a coach, you want to put your best guys on the field. So what gives you a chance to score the best? You know, if you're going 11 personnel, which is a tight end, a running back, and three receivers – and your tight end's not blocking, is that really a run formation? Is that really a run personnel group? Or you're just trotting out a tight end out there to say, yeah, we use tight ends. You know, it ultimately, you've got to find your best, and everybody's different. You got to find your best personnel and go from there.
You know, thinking of that, you know, just off the top of my head, you think of how Belichick would, or any of these NFL coaches that are looking to mask a run formation off of a pass formation. You as a a college coach, do you have enough time to be varied, to be able to put those type of packages in where, you know, you just mentioned having a tight end in there with what looks to be, you know, a very spread offense otherwise? How do you kind of mix and match that?
You have enough time if your offensive coordinator says you have enough time, you know, and your head coach is, you script so many plays a day and you run so many plays a day that if it's important enough to you and you want to work on it, you have enough time. You only have X amount of hours in a week. You have a 20-hour rule in the NCAA. So, you know, the more plays you attempt to run, the risk you run from that standpoint is you're running a lot of plays poorly. So, you know, our philosophy at Kutztown has been this past year, we have seemingly to the outside world a lot of plays, but there's some window dressing with formations and motions and some personnel. But for our guys, once they get the basic idea of the formations and the communication of the play and the signals, which ultimately is some of the hardest things that outside people don't realize, is all these hand signals. Most kids can grasp the concepts, but the how you signal it in and the communication, it's a whole new language. That's the hard part for 18, 19-year-old kids that prevents them from having an impact early on as a college receiver or a different position. But you have enough time if you want to have enough time. That's the offensive coordinator's decision to make it that much time. He has to weigh whether it's worth it. You know, he has to make that decision. Most offensive coordinators, they want to have a ton of plays.
All right, welcome back, Steve. One of the things we've started to do with our first guest and even with ourselves is we were talking about golf and specifically the Masters. And one of the great things about the Masters is if you win it, you come back the next year and you get to put whatever you like food-wise on the menu. So we put you to the test. What would, if you win that green jacket, you come back the following year, what's on your menu?
It's prime rib. It's got to be medium rare. It can't be well done because then it's a catcher's mitt. People that eat prime rib well done, you really got to question them why they're doing that to a very nice meat. Broccoli, some sort of green vegetable, baked potato. I have sour cream available for folks that like it. I have butter available. I'm very simple. I'm a meat and potatoes guy. But it'd be prime rib, baked potato, salad, broccoli. That would be my menu.
Now, you forgot your soda. What choice of soda would you be looking at? RC, Green Spot? You know, what are we taking a look at?
Well, the key with soda for me would be I would avoid it with the prime rib because it's filling. So I'd be drinking water, and I wouldn't be drinking a ton of water, but I would be avoiding the calories with soda because I try not to drink a lot of calories. I will eat plenty of calories. I don't need to be consuming them through liquids. But I would have every soda available to the folks that come there. And I love soda. I love sugary things. I just saw that there was a big battle in New York State about a soda tax. Or no, it was in Philadelphia.
Philly, yeah.
Yep. About a soda tax. I'm anti-soda tax. I think the sodas are expensive as it is, and I'm anti-tax in general. So my conservative bent leads me to be anti-soda tax.
All right, and, you know, next we have our NASCAR segment. Again, we talked about the Chip Kelly no huddle, hurry up, and this is our version where you're going to get 6 rapid-fire questions from Reams, and you're going to have to answer them as quickly as possible. Are you ready?
Let's go.
The great thing about it is we'll take a little autopsy. We'll look at the film afterwards. So here we go, Steve. Ready?
Ready.
All right, first question. The one sporting event you have to watch during the year?
Indy 500.
Okay. Most influential coach in your playing career or coaching career?
Harvey Bockert.
All right. Third question. Army, Navy, who do you root for?
Army. They're usually the underdog.
All right. Next question. Favorite athlete?
Steve Largent.
Next question, under center or shotgun?
Shotgun.
And the last one, which Harbaugh would you rather play for?
John.
Wow.
Interesting answers.
You know, to go back over some of these, you know, you picked Harvey Bakker. What was it about Harvey that stood out to you?
Harvey was the first coach that I had that forced me out of my comfort zone and really unearthed my potential as a competitor first and then as an athlete second. He demanded that you compete, and I had never had a coach that demanded that players compete, and he wouldn't tolerate anything but my best. And he knew what my best was, and that's the mark to me of a great coach. He knew what every kid's best was, and I don't think he was, you know, a genius in terms of, you know, strategy. He was great strategy, but that's not why he was a great coach. I mean, a lot of guys quit the years that we started playing when Coach Bakker came on board, and it elevated me to get me more playing time because other people quit, and I just took whatever he had and recognized that it would make me a better player. Doesn't mean I enjoyed it. We didn't always enjoy it, but he got me out of my comfort zone, and I learned a lot about coaching and myself and the sport through him, who was a great competitor as a player and was a championship-winning coach. So I really have a lot of the debt of gratitude to him as a coach.
That's some good stuff. You mentioned Steve Largent. I'm going to surmise it's probably because of the technical aspect of his game, or is it because you're a Seahawks fan?
Yeah, both. I mean, he was a Hall of Fame NFL receiver, diminutive, you know, 5'10", 5'11". He was the Ray Barry of his era in terms of route running ability, but also got into politics after his career was over, went to Tulsa. I was a huge Seahawks fan as a kid. I don't see myself as a fan of sports too much more anymore, but I could have listed a lot of athletes. Arnold Palmer would have been one, but he was not of my era. He was my father's era. But Steve Largent, never had really had a chance to meet Largent. I have an autographed Tulsa mini helmet, but I liked what he stood for. You didn't hear much out of him, just very productive.
You said Indy 500?
Indy 500, to me, that's...
So you're more Formula One than NASCAR?
I'm an open wheel guy at heart, but I will enjoy anything that they race. NASCAR, Formula One, sports cars, drag racing, IndyCar. Next weekend I'll be out at Mid-Ohio for the IndyCar race. That's my really true passion right now in terms of, you know, football is great, and right now this time of year in the summer, racing is my number one.
So now, do you like NASCAR truck?
That was on last night. They raced at Eldora at Tony Stewart's track, a half mile in Ohio, and I watched most of it simply because it's Wednesday night in the middle of July and there's nothing else on, but I watched it. Not my favorite type, but there were a lot of exciting drivers in there. Not sure NASCAR trucks should be racing on dirt. But, you know, again, I have an interest in the sport in general, and then I have a pecking order. It's like most people, if they're a ball and stick fan, you know, the guys are really hardcore golf, then they kind of watch baseball. For me, racing is a major sport, and then there's sub sports underneath it, you know, and Indy cars is number one. Sports cars would be number two. Formula One, NASCAR, they kind of trickle down from there.
I'm going to forget about your answer for the Army-Navy. I'm a Navy guy, Bender's Army, but that's fine. But explain your Harbaugh pick.
I like Jim Harbaugh used to be an IndyCar owner, but I just like John's demeanor on the sideline. I like John's demeanor on the sideline. It seems like he's wired a little differently. I think his players respond to it. He's got a Super Bowl.
Who does he have that Super Bowl over? Go on. I go ahead.
I just think he cut his teeth as a special teams coordinator, became a head coach. So, you know, for Cody Bender, who's a special teams guru, to me, John Harbaugh would be one of the guys he would look up to with the idea of becoming a head coach someday. And there's nothing against Jim. You know, I think Jim Harbaugh has proven to be an excellent coach. But if I had to pick one, I think John would be the guy.
I'm surprised you didn't pick the old man.
Well, yeah, Western Kentucky, yeah. Hilltoppers.
Hey, great coach.
Jack Harbaugh.
Thanks again for listening to the Poolside Genius Podcast. Don't miss out on spending time poolside, so subscribe using iTunes, Stitcher, or any other major podcast platforms. While you are subscribing, we appreciate any feedback and 5-star reviews.
Remember, when you're poolside, always dive in the deep end.
Splash.